KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment from New York. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, Hazel Rowley, wrote a book I thought was quite amazing that was published a few years ago, Richard Wright, His Life and Times, that I still recommend to people because it was really about romance and the, I think, a real sort of intellectual, a love of intellectualism, love of ideas. And that book is, that ideal is even more prevalent in her new book, Tête-à-Tête, Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre. Hazel, welcome. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you, Elvis.
Tell me, first of all, what made you feel you wanted to write this book?
Well, it came out of the Richard Wright book, actually. There is a strong connection between these books. I think people wonder how I can lurch from, you know, the biography of an American black man to two French intellectuals. But they had a major effect on each other. Richard Wright was influenced by existentialism. And their idea, Sartre and Beauvoir's idea of the committed intellectual, was really influenced by Richard Wright, and they printed some of his work in the very first issue of L'État moderne in 1945, and they kept printing him. They were the ones, really, who put Richard Wright on the map in France. And as you know, he moved to Paris in the 50s.
What's fascinating to me about the book is that you sort of start as with kind of the end, your meeting with de Beauvoir, and you talk in the preface in a really wonderful way about the way she had become the basically the keeper of the flame in a way. She maintained that mythology, and as you further researched the book, you kind of found that that was really just almost kind of a hollow pose on her behalf.
Well, it's true that Simone de Beauvoir wrote many volumes of memoirs, and even if she wasn't married to Sartre, these memoirs gave her an opportunity to say to the world, I am the partner of Jean-Paul Sartre, and no woman measures up to me in his affections. So, I mean, in a sense, she was wearing a very large wedding ring as a result of these books. And she was leaving out certain of Sartre's girlfriends, and she was making slightly snide remarks about other ones. So writing memoirs, and in a way being Sartre's Boswell, you know, being Sartre's biographer, gave her a certain amount of control. And when I interviewed her in 1976 in her apartment in Paris, I saw how much this sort of myth of the perfect relationship, you know, never any jealousy, never going to sleep for one night in disharmony, which is impossible, by the way, and which I saw in the book did not happen. This was the myth she was maintaining to me in the interview I had with her.
I thought what was kind of telling, too, is that you open the book with him meeting her sister, and the movie takes her to see is a girl in every port, which if you had actually written that in the movie, people would still be laughing at you.
Right.
Something so telling.
Yes, that's right. The very first date he was meant to have with Simone de Beauvoir, she asked her sister to go instead. And she even said to the sister, you know, you'll recognize him because he's a very ugly man. Ooh!
Well, but that's fascinating, too, about, I think, both Sartre and Richard Wright, I think, is there's this real, almost this intellectual vanity, this love of sort of expressing oneself in the most silken, I think, of erudition, and that comes across in Sartre very much too, doesn't it?
Yes, sure. Intellectual ideas were everything to him, and I think that's what was so seductive about Sartre. Because people ask me, you know, how come he managed to have so many girlfriends? This man who was sort of 5'2" and who had eyes that went in different directions, and so on. And the answer is that he was just full of ideas and humor and imagination. And he listened to women, you know, he made them feel interesting. That's always a good trick for a seducer.
But it's really touching when you sort of start with that. And I have this image in my head of him circling this young girl on the bicycle and her finally just making fun of him. When are you going to stop?
Yes, that's right. That was when Sartre was 12 and living with his mother who had remarried, which was a crisis in Sartre's life. He was in love with his mother, and he thought that when he grew up, he would marry her. His father died when he was 2. And so that was bad enough that his mother had remarried. But then he got keen on this girl and he was riding his bike and looping around her in circles. And she said to his, she said in front of her friends, "Who are you, you ugly guy with your silly glasses and your big hat?" And he said it was at that moment when he was 12 that he realized how ugly he was and that he was going to have to do something very drastic if he was going to get girls in the future. So he used his golden tongue.
It's kind of funny because I think of the book, and I mentioned this to you before we started, it feels to me almost like a Maupassant story, just about there's so much heartbreak in the book and so much of it kind of self-engendered. I mean, it's almost as if somehow Sartre made himself into this tragic figure at a very young age.
Made himself into a tragic figure. I mean, I think it was very, very hard for him to feel ugly. And that was something he never got over, really, to the point that he, as an adult, didn't like asking directions to people in the street because he felt that he was imposing his body on them. Well, I wanted to show this aspect of Sartre because on the one hand we have this existentialist philosopher who believes that, you know, we are free and that life is a series of choices, and yet underneath it all he was driven by these neuroses.
I'm talking to Hazel Riley. It's a treatment. Her book is Tête-à-Tête, Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir. And what really impresses me about the writing is, as well as it seemed to sort of make you redefine your feelings about the two of them in some way.
Yes, it did. What was interesting about writing this book, which really was an act of passion, was that Simone de Beauvoir had influenced me a lot in my early life. I studied French in South Australia. And I read Simone de Beauvoir. I should say that I went to university in 1969, which was the beginning of the women's movement, just like the Black Power movement. It was a time when things were changing. And I could see around me these friends of my mother who weren't having a particularly exciting time. And Simone de Beauvoir, her memoirs, her relationship with Sartre, the books she read, the affairs she had, the traveling she did, the writing she did, she worked hard, she played hard. It seemed so exciting. And so she became a real model to me. And I told my boyfriends in my 20s, you know, nobody owns me, I'm free, you know, we have to love each other in our freedom and all this kind of existentialist stuff. And now in my middle age, a few years ago, I thought this would be really interesting to go back to this relationship and see what I think of it now. You know, did Beauvoir tell the truth? What was Sartre's side of the picture? And yes, I was really exploring something which had had an amazing impact on my life.
I guess as you talk about this, it makes me wonder if you ask yourself that question at some point, even in your 20s, was she being direct? Because in reading the reviews about of the book, some of the things I've seen, they sort of talk about the disingenuousness that the two of them really came to embody in a way. And I wonder if you even felt that at some point reading those memoirs or maybe even in parts of the Mandarin.
Well, you're right that I think in the memoirs, you sometimes think to yourself, this couldn't have been that good. The Mandarins, that the novel Simone de Beauvoir wrote, which was based very heavily on her relationship with Nelson Algren and on her life with Sartre during the post-war years, Simone de Beauvoir's fiction does show you a bit of the shadow side of her life, and you realize things that you don't realize from her memoirs. But yes, it was perhaps after they died when their letters to each other were published. I think that that was the moment when all of us were shocked, all of us, down to the last reader. We realized when we read those letters that they hadn't told the truth to their lovers and that they were complicit in a lot of lie-telling.
Well, because I came to the Mandarin fairly late, only a couple of years ago, and it changed my mind about her because there are allusions in that book to a kind of dissatisfaction and a kind of curiosity about love that was never expressed in any of those letters at all, that or those memoirs that had been published before that.
Yes, you're right. You remind me about that aspect of the book. I think, too, that she wrote the Mandarin. She wrote the Mandarins in the 1950s. She was then still only in her 40s, but Beauvoir always had a really premature sense of what it was going to be like to age. And I think my book shows that, and it's still true today, that there's a complete double standard for women and for men when it comes to aging. And she writes about this in her famous feminist essay, The Second Sex. She says that women lose their sexual desirability long before they lose their sexual desire. And the Mandarins, she was already having strong premonitions of this moment in her life. And it's true that it happened to her. She didn't really have an affair with a man after she was 50, whereas Sartre got uglier and uglier and had younger and younger women hanging off his arm.
I guess I'm wondering, too, if you, as you were discovering these sorts of fissures, I guess we can say, in the mythology that they so seriously maintain, if you began to feel closer to them because they felt less like ideals and more like people.
Yeah, that's a good question. Look, there were days when I thought to myself, when I was writing this book, when I thought to myself, boy, they really were, you know, bad, not particularly noble, not particularly admirable. But on the whole, and particularly when I was revising the book, I was absolutely buoyed by inspiration. It was the other stuff that became paramount to me, their loyalty to friends, their generosity with people. Sartre was a wealthy man, but he gave his money away, and he died a poor man. He gave money to his girlfriends. He gave money to causes. He asked his publishers not to give him an advance because he was such a bad spender. So he asked for a monthly allowance. And at the beginning of the month when the allowance came in, he just wrote checks to all his girlfriends. I mean, today, still after his death, various women are still living off him.
It's The Treatment. My guest is Hazel Riley. Her book is Tête-à-Tête, Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir. I guess what I'm really sort of touched by in the book, and I keep talking about Maupassant, is that sort of sense of grasping and kind of jealousies that came out of nowhere, which you would never get a sense of from reading any of the memoirs or anything that he had written either. That there was a kind of a detachment, a looking at things outside him rather than examining himself. And I wondered if that was one of the things, too, that kept you going in the book, just, again, pulling back all these layers.
I was particularly interested in the Sartre side of the story, I must say, because unlike Simone de Beauvoir, you're right, he doesn't write about himself much. His fiction, his plays were about other people. Whereas, you know, she was writing not only her memoirs, but she writes about the death of her mother. She writes eventually about the death of Sartre. So I was very interested in covering up the big gap that is Jean-Paul Sartre. I wanted to know what his side of the story was. And I managed to find out. I managed to get hold of hundreds of letters to his girlfriends, which nobody had ever seen before, unpublished material. And that really showed me, you know, the inward Sartre, the inner man.
Did you feel that in finding that? I mentioned Balzac and that wonderful Balzac quote that comes to me about within, inside every cynic beats the heart of a true romantic. Part of that romanticism or that romantic sense for me is you talk about his work ethic in that way that's very similar to Balzac. Essentially, Balzac chained himself to the table to write every day, and Sartre would do the same thing. He would spend the entire day. There's a rigor that we get a sense of, especially from the book.
I'm glad you get that sense because, of course, that really worried me when I was writing a book that concentrated on their relationship. I was conscious every day of the danger of trivializing them. And so I'm glad that you say that because I very much wanted to put the whole love affair thing in context and show how hard they worked. I don't know anybody who worked as hard as Sartre and Beauvoir. Really every day and 8 hours in 4-hour stretches, you know, 9 until 1, then they'd have a very long lunch, and then they'd do another burst from 4 till 8. And in the afternoon, they worked side by side. Beauvoir went around to Sartre's apartment and worked on another little table beside his. Even, you know, weekends, even vacations.
We will take a break. My guest is Hazel Rowley. Her wonderful lyrical book is Tête-à-Tête, Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest is Hazel Rowley. Her wonderful book is Tête-à-Tête, Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, their relationship, which she exposes, and I think exposes is the word here, the amount of sort of – I think their allegiance to mythology is so strong that they end up deceiving themselves in some fairly major ways.
They did deceive themselves in some ways.
And I have to say, and I'm going to ask you to read a section of the book, the section you talk about her being in New York and meeting Nelson Algren just has kind of a wonderful
sort Chicago.
Of, Chicago, I'm sorry. Has just kind of a wonderful poetry and really sort of romantic and dramatic. And that seems to me a portion that must have meant a great deal to you. There's a lot – it feels like there's a lot of work in that section.
Well, Nelson Algren, I think, was a pretty sexy man and incredibly more sexy than Sartre. And this was an affair which meant a great deal to her because at that time, Sartre and Beauvoir were very taken with America. This was, you know, American literature had influenced them, Hemingway, Dos Passos, Steinbeck, jazz, blues, you know, black America. They were absolutely enchanted by this country, the skyscrapers, you know, and so on. By the way, of course, that changed in the McCarthy period. They grew furious with the U.S. But this was – Nelson Algren came with an America which she loved.
And that's just – in that section of the book, it really feels romantic to me. It could be a movie. I mean, it really feels like it has that kind of scope and there's a kind of an epic sense of romance. And if you could read that section for me, please.
So this is 1947 and Simone de Beauvoir is traveling around the U.S. She was in Chicago for 36 hours. It was the end of February, so the streets were covered in snow and the wind cut like a razor. She didn't feel like seeing the city by herself. Friends in New York had given her the address of a writer, Nelson Algren. Algren was 38, a year younger than Beauvoir. She had been warned that he was a moody, difficult fellow. Beauvoir plucked up her courage and dialed. A man answered. She blustered into the phone with her thick French accent. The man hung up. She dialed again and spoke louder. "Wrong number," he said. After three tries, she was crimson with embarrassment and asked the hotel operator to help. "There's a party here that would like to speak to you," the operator told Algren. He was used to misplaced calls in thick accents from Polish immigrants who had never used a phone before and was busy cooking something on his stove. This time he listened more carefully to what he later described as that hoarse screech. To Beauvoir's relief, he sounded more friendly. That evening, in the hotel bar, she saw a tall blonde man with wire-frame glasses and a leather waistcoat come through the door and look her up and down with surprise. Beauvoir told him she was tired of luxury hotels and elegant restaurants. Would he show her the real Chicago? Algren took her to Chicago's Bowery, to a strip club, a Negro bar, and a gangster tavern, where music blared out from the jukebox and a variety of tramps, crooks, drug addicts, and whores propped themselves up at the counter. He felt at home in places like this, Algren said. These people were his friends. Between his mumbling Midwestern drawl and her strong French accent, they had trouble understanding each other. At first, she plied him with questions, and he answered laconically. But by the end of the evening, he was telling her about his life. He was born in Detroit, he said, and brought up in a poor immigrant district on the south side of Chicago. His mother was Jewish and his father Swedish, but he didn't feel either. During the Depression, after graduating in journalism from the University of Illinois, he had traveled in the south hopping freight trains and had served a 4-month term in a Texas prison for stealing a typewriter. Back in Chicago, he was involved in a communist writers' group. It was the best time of his life. During the war, he'd served in the army in France. He didn't speak French, but he liked the French. On his way to and from Europe, he had stopped in New York. Otherwise, he had scarcely left Chicago. They arranged to see each other the following afternoon. Beauvoir had to attend lunch with people from the Alliance Française. As soon as she could, she asked the French consul to drop her off at Algren's. The consul drove her to the Polish district, past warehouses, vacant lots, and rows of squalid wooden houses with scruffy backyards. At 1523 West Wabanzia Avenue, she stepped out into the snow, waved goodbye to the consul, and knocked on the door. The place was a hovel.
That was Hazel Rowley reading from her book, Tête-à-Tête. That, you get that feeling, too, that what she probably fell in love with Chicago was something that's similar to Paris, a real sort of a love of kind of working-class intellectualism that was a very much a part of the Chicago of that time.
Yes, and I must say that's something I like about Beauvoir and Sartre. They weren't interested in materialism, the acquisition of possessions. They believed that the real city was the poor people.
And as we were saying, one of the things that's so wonderful about the book to me is that it shows your appreciation of what existentialism really is and how it had been misinterpreted, and that Sartre himself had to often explain to people what it was. They felt like it was almost – it was basically the modern – the equivalent at that point of postmodernism, which is another term that people often misunderstand.
Exactly. Existentialism was – it became a buzzword. It all happened really in 1945 after the war. And you have to remember that, you know, there'd been the experience of the Nazi occupation of Paris, there'd been the Holocaust, the atom bomb, and people felt very powerless. And along came this French philosopher called Jean-Paul Sartre with his idea of existentialism, in which he said that the individual is free to some extent, even in the worst possible circumstances. And that freedom makes you dizzy because although it's exciting, it comes with responsibility. And that life is a series of choices, he said, and we are the sum total of our actions. It's no good saying you could have written a good book if you'd not had four children. You write a good book. You are the person at the end of your life who shows what you were by your actions.
It fascinates me in the book, too, that there's so much of what you're talking about, that attempt to live by those ideals and that sort of denial of the kind of pain that he was leaving by using freedom as his way to sort of get into other people's lives.
Yes, he was capable of using his philosophy to his own advantage. But I do think that on the whole, his life was an existentialist life.
Life or an existentialist quest? Now, maybe that's kind of too fine a definition, but I'm curious.
He and Beauvoir tried to live that life, not always successfully. They believed that they were free. And you've got to remember that the world they met each other in 1929, women and men, there was a complete double standard. You know, Sartre, like all his friends, went to brothels and, you know, had experience of prostitutes. Beauvoir was a virgin when she met him. Women could not go to the École Normale Supérieure, which Sartre went to, the most elite educational institution in France. Women couldn't vote. And for Simone de Beauvoir to have had a sort of good bourgeois marriage, she would have had to come with a dowry. Can you imagine a dowry? And because her father lost his money during the First World War, she did not have a dowry. So she became, you know, she studied philosophy instead to become a teacher, which is how she met Sartre. So it was in that world, against that context, that these two people met and decided to lead lives of freedom. And Sartre said to her, you know, you are as free as I am. I want you to lead your life just like I do. Go out and have adventures, have affairs, come back and see me and we'll talk about them. She was jealous quite a bit, but they believed that jealousy is an emotion which isn't necessarily a good emotion, that we do have willpower and that we should work on our emotions.
Yet neither of them, especially he, were capable of rising above jealousy that often, were they?
No, they didn't rise above it, but they fought it. That's more interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, but I guess I'm talking too about that sense of remove, of almost ironic detachment in his work that makes all of this wrestling with feelings so surprising to me.
Yes, Sartre denied a great deal, I think, both in his work and in his life. Mostly he denied his weaknesses.
It's The Treatment. My guest is Hazel Rowley. We're talking about her book, Tête à Tête, Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre. I guess in the last section of the book, where that pursuit of these ideals and the sort of distance between that and the way that he led his life as she became, as you talk about, less physically desirable, takes a real, I think, tragic turn for me.
No, the end of the life is a pretty sad story. First of all, Simone de Beauvoir coming to terms with aging. She found that a real struggle. She was a very sensuous woman. And Sartre got very sick, really, 10 years before he died. In the 1950s, he abused his body an enormous amount. I think that Sartre was very, very disillusioned by the world in the 1950s. by America and McCarthyism, by the Cold War and, you know, the fear of the atom bomb, by the Algerian War, which was one of the dirtiest wars.
And having to accept what France was becoming at that point.
The torture that the French were doing in Algeria was just terrible, and Sartre and Beauvoir were among the few to talk about that. The French press hushed it up, but Les Temps Modernes, they were talking about this torture and so on. So Sartre, I think, was a very depressed man, and he made up for it by drinking vast quantities of alcohol and taking huge quantities of speed, which allowed him to get over his depression and work and write like a kind of, as if possessed by a devil. And he said it made him feel that he was changing the world as a writer. You know, I don't think that Sartre really wanted to be a writer. He would have preferred to have been Che Guevara or somebody. But the fact is, drugs made him feel as if he were important. And the drugs eventually got to him, and he became blind and really sick for the last 10 years of his life.
You mentioned that because of the schedule, because that grueling schedule, even at that point, before he began to really abuse himself to try to keep up, that those weaknesses were making themselves manifest.
During the war, even, that's right, that his eyes were tired, and sometimes he actually wrote with his eyes closed, exactly, to try to rest his one eye. But it was a terrible thing for a man for whom everything is writing and reading to become blind.
I guess I wonder, because the book feels to me like such a rebuke of this orthodoxy that exists around them, even to the extent that when the letters started to come out and the Quince et cetera, written by one of her lovers, those letters between Beauvoir and
Bost.
And Bost, people still tried to deny that because they didn't want to feel it. Do you feel that you were going to be bucking the tide a bit by writing this book?
Well, it seems that I have, because the reception's been very mixed. On the whole, I've had very favorable reviews, but I've had some absolute scorches. And I realized eventually that Sartre and Beauvoir have always kicked up dust. They have always been hated. I mean, I hope that my book makes clear that the degree to which they were vehemently hated in their lifetime by conservatives and by people who just didn't like what they represented. And, of course, my book comes along and talks about them again, and I think some people don't even have to take up the book or read it properly. They write a review which already has decided that they're going to hate this couple.
Again, because I think people after their deaths had come to embrace those ideals so strongly they couldn't bear to hear anything that basically said there is more, that they were much more complicated people.
Yes,
and
human.
Memoirs. Yeah, sure.
I agree with you. I think the problem that people like this have is that they are either, you know, sacred icons and nobody can touch them, or else they're sacred monsters and everybody hates them. But I'm trying to show that they were flawed and human and vulnerable and insecure in their way, but also very charming and tender people.
You do all that and more, Hazel. Thank you so much for out of time.
Well, thank you, Elvis.
My guest is Hazel Rowley. Her book is Tête-à-Tête, Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre. Our technical director in KCRW in Santa Monica is Mario Diaz, with assistance from Lashik Wojcik at Carnegie Studios in New York. Bob Carlson is the editor. Mary Holdridge produces the program. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.